You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is We'll Always Have Paris. My name is Paul, and I'm from Edinburgh, and I have a cold, as you can probably tell.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. And Paul has a cold, but he's still willing to go on, aren't you, Paul?
Well, do you know, I thought that you might actually put your fist through the internet and punch me in the throat if you missed another recording.
I wouldn't do that. I don't want Mrs. Emma after me. Although I still say, looking at your picture on Skype, she is a pretty one.
She's downstairs sitting the dogs tonight, so.
Oh, cool. Be quiet. Daddy's on a show. Be quiet. Okay. Why don't you tell us a little about yourself, and you are also a member of Trekmate.
So I do the Enterprise equivalent of the Battle Bridge, called Previously in the Alpha Quadrant, which is also on Trekmate. But whereas you're a new fledgling podcast, we're an old man podcast that is about to expire. Mm-hmm. We just hit season 4 of Enterprise, which is like season 7 of TNG. It's the big goodbye. So we've recorded the first couple of episodes of season 4. Season 4 is actually quite a short season anyway.
Yeah, it is. Well, yeah. Let me see if you agree with this notion I have. The reason why Enterprise was using their shuttle exclusively is because they could do what other series could not, and that was use CGI to have their shuttle departure and landing and so on. And then as the series went on, they said, why are we doing this? Why don't we're going to have to use a transporter, because in the future series, they use a transporter exclusively. Do you think that sounds about right?
Yeah, I think it's probably the reverse of why TOS used the transporter. So TOS used the transporter because to do a shuttle landing sequence would have been a really expensive effect. So they invented the transporter as a really neat way of saying, well, how did we get from the ship to the planet? Well, we pressed a button and there we were. Whereas by the time you get to Enterprise, you know, they've reversed it to the point where they've already built the models and CG, and I think that you know, they with you having access to that kind of thing, it makes it much easier for you to just kind of re-render those shots. But I think to answer the question, what Enterprise done a lot in season 4 was basically get to the point where they're TNG light. You know, everything is in place that they've kind of bypassed TOS almost, and we're at the point where, you know, the NX-01 might as well be the kind of direct progenitor to the Enterprise D. You know, they've got the photon torpedoes, they've got the tractor beam. The only thing they don't have is the shields.
Yeah. Okay. All right then. And we'll put a link to Previously in the Alpha Quadrant on our main page, which is on TrekmateFamily.com.
So the synopsis for tonight's show is Captain Picard encounters a woman from his past after her scientist husband's experiments begin to unravel the fabric of time. So this is the 20th episode of Season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date was May 2nd, 1988. And this episode was written by Deborah Dean Davis and Hannah Louise Shearer, and directed by Robert Becker. Guest stars include Michelle Phillips as Janice Mannheim, Rod Loomis as Paul Mannheim, Isabel Loca as Gabrielle.
Howdy! Sorry.
Dan Cairns as Lieutenant Dean, and Jean-Paul Vignon as Edward.
Edward.
And Kelly Ashmore as Francine. And finally, Lance Spielberg as Transporter Chief.
Yeah, I think it was Edward. I will get you something special. Anyway.
So, James, did you right away know that it wasn't an accurate representation of Paris because the waiters were far too friendly?
yes. That is true. I mean, perhaps that's the most unlikely thing of the entire show, right? Forget about all of the time experiments and there being multiple copies of data. There was a friendly waiter in Paris. That I just can't believe.
Oh. Well, we are in the... It is in the 24th century. I mean, maybe they've changed. Less likely, but maybe they've changed.
That's true. I do consider that fact.
All right. Well, before we get into the show, we do have some forum feedback. And we left off with episode 20, review of Heart of Glory. And that's the one we had the Klingon on. So before we read the forum stuff, James, you actually sent a message on email about your thoughts on Heart of Glory. Why don't you tell them what you thought, how it turned out in the end?
Oh, I did, because, sorry, you're putting me on the spot here. I emailed you yesterday because I had a backlog of Battle Bridge to get through, and I didn't want to have more than my fair share in the queue. So I ended up listening to Heart of Glory, and obviously I'm never, just for the listener to know, I'm never involved in the post-production at all. So all of the how everything was edited together, with Brian coming on with the Klingon music, I heard it first when I downloaded the episode. Mm-hmm. I am also aware that we did forum feedback before Brian was around, but it was cut into the episode as well.
Right.
So very nicely done there.
Yes, yes. Editing, obviously, there's no way, unless you were here listening with me and having to decide what stays and what goes, it's obviously I just do it on my own. And the easiest thing is, I listen to podcasts at work, so this is where I kind of edit these shows. I listen to it, and as I get something that needs to go, I stop, mark the time, and what it is that has to go, and then when I get home, I can easily edit them. And you have to go backwards from the end to the beginning, because if you went from the beginning to the end, all those times would change. So that's how I do it. And then eventually what I do with putting things like the forum before, or putting, and we say in the show, oh, I need to put this at the beginning of something. Then obviously I can put it a segment, export that segment only to a file name, and then I can dump them in on Acoustica MP3 tool. What's it called? Oh, MP3 audio mixer. Acoustica MP3 audio mixer, and that makes it easier to do. So, yeah, that was fun, and that's, I think, as far as I can remember, at that time it was 21 episodes. That's the first time I ever went off of our beaten path, isn't it?
I think there have been bits and pieces before. I think there are bits and pieces in there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, just stop the TNG music, bring on the Klingon, and then continue on. So that was fun to do, and I was glad Brian came on. Okay, so in our forum, however, we have 6 responses, 5 of which is to let me know that I messed up the RSS feed. And why don't you tell everybody your observation about these first 5 that you thought was interesting?
Oh, what I like about it is that between them, they have 20 thumbs up.
Yes.
So, you said 4 for Colin, 6 for Mark, 3 for yourself, 2 for Paul, and 4 for Paul, and then another 3 for Colin.
Yeah.
So,
I thought that was funny. Colin's telling me, hey, it's not hitting the RSS feed. And Mark says, well, I think we screwed up the tweak of the RSS feed. And, oh, no, it wasn't you guys. I completely forgot to put it on the second blog. Because, yeah, that's what I do currently. And we're working in on this. But, Loot Trek Show has its own RSS feed. And since I'm not really doing the Loot Trek Show, I do want them to hear us. So I put the Battle Bridge on the Loot Trek Show feed, which will be changing, guys. We have not nailed it down, but there's going to be a change in the feed. I'll have a very simple link as soon as we assemble that. And you just follow it, and boom, update your feed. That simple. Because we don't want to lose you. I hope you don't want to lose us. So then Kieran McDuff, who needs to correct us on one thing. He says, you're right. I usually do agree with most of what you say on the podcast. I'd like to know what he disagrees, because we never hear disagreements, do we, James?
No. Although, would anyone listen to us just to disagree with us? Maybe these are the people that don't listen.
That could be. Yes, I'm sure there's a few more people that don't listen than people that do listen. I don't know for sure. That made no sense. And he says, no, Kieran McDuff isn't my real name. Oh, okay. No, we were sure it wasn't, but he says, I'm not a huge fan of this episode. I've always found it pretty boring, to be honest. The scenes on the Batris seem to drag on quite a bit, and although the idea of seeing what Geordi sees is pretty interesting, it gets to the motion picture length of staring at pretty colors. Did they ever use Geordi vision again? I'm not sure they did. I know we had the Romulan version of it when they were programming him to kill, and we had the Klingons doing it in Generations, but I don't think the Enterprise crew ever did the interface with a different concept again. So before we go on, do you remember any, James, that we might run across? Geordi vision?
Okay, yes. So there's certainly Geordi vision in the... the mind's eye, right?
Right.
That's the one where the Romulans get Geordi to be the killer. I also think that we see from his perspective in The Enemy when he's on a planet with a Romulan in season 3.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they show it because he's trying to find something. He's trying to find a piece of metal or something like that. And I think they use it there. I mean, of course, famously, it's in Generations,
yeah.
Or at least a point of view of Geordi's in Generation, but it's not like funky vision, it's normal vision. Just effectively, they added on Google Glass to his visor, and they just saw a standard camera, Lerto and Beto. And actually, when I listened to it, I did remember that Interface, the episode that he's referenced, which is the season 7 episode, is when they managed to link Geordi into a probe. I don't think at any point we ever saw what Geordi saw through the visor. Instead, it was that Geordi was able to behave as the probe, but the probe saw everything in standard, standard vision.
Right.
That's all that I can remember.
Actually, it seemed more like the camera crew was where Geordi was, as the probe was actually going to. We were just seeing things as a spectator in his world, not really through his eyes. And as far as the Generations one, I think the reason why they did that is I assume that there's going to be a lot of people who went to see Star Trek Generations who never saw TNG. So if they were to have Geordi vision, I wonder if they would probably have a problem with that.
Actually, let me pull you up on that for a second. Because I often hear stuff saying that, you have to make the films different to the TV series. Do people go to see a Star Trek film that don't watch a Star Trek TV series?
I wouldn't think so, but I do think so, because that's why sometimes they have to re-explain a lot of things.
I know that the standard wisdom is that you need to explain it and you need to bring in the new people, but sometimes I'm not necessarily sure that that's always needed. I don't know. Maybe I'm just thinking as a fanboy, they should just make a a film for the fanboys and everything would be fine and we'll go and see it and we don't need anything for the new people trying to get into the series from the scratch. But I would find it peculiar, certainly Generations, right, which is, you know, the TNG's first movie. If you haven't watched Star Trek Next Generation, why are you really going to see Generations on the big screen? To me, it wouldn't make sense.
That's true. And when, you know, I was just thinking about Generations, really, they didn't explain the whole Duras and the whole Duras thing. They just went on with, we know who Lursar and Bator are, and this is how they deal with it. So, maybe. It makes sense. Why would you go to the movie?
By the way, I saw Generations in the cinema more times than I've seen any other Star Trek film in the cinema, probably then put together.
Really?
Because when's Generations? 94? Something like that? 93, 94?
I don't remember.
I'll give away my age. I was... At around that time, I would have been 13, 14 or so, depending on what year it came out. I think it came out in England over summer or summer-ish. And I wasn't at school. I had a lot of spare time. And the cinema that we had in my hometown was relatively cheap. And I saw Generations in the cinema 13 times.
Wow.
The next one is, I think I saw I saw Star Trek 09 twice, and I saw First Contact twice. But other than that, everything is just once.
You know, what's fascinating is I don't remember actually taking anyone to see Star Trek. I feel like I went on by myself, because I don't think anybody really gets Star Trek that I know like I do. They don't get it. Nobody gets my show. Nobody gets the idea of me hosting a Star Trek podcast. That's cool. That's all right.
Oh, I mean, but by the way, when I say I went to see Generations 13 times, I'm certain at least 10 of them was by myself. So,
yeah.
13
times. Wow.
Okay. It's a good film. It's a good film.
Oh, yeah, it really is. All right, let's go on with Kieran's message. It says, by the time we get to rescuing the Klingons, they've eaten up a lot of show already, but still not a whole lot happens. We get the Klingon death ritual, which I love. One scream to let the afterlife know someone's coming, and then throw away an empty shell. I'll be honest, if I thought I could get away with it, I'd want my funeral to be something similar. But then, even the rest of the episode is a bit tedious, sitting around talking about what it means to be a Klingon with Worf. We get loads of these stories in the future episodes, and almost all of them are done a lot better than these conversations in crew quarters. We get a little better... I'm sorry, it gets a little better once they build the weapon and go on the rampage, but even that's not exactly a lot of hand-to-hand combat. It's not a bad episode, as it doesn't have much in the way of plot holes, but it's not one you're going to choose to watch over and over. No. If you want a good Klingon episode, there's plenty more later in TNG as well as DS9 and even in Voyager. This is one more of a teaser than anything else. 2 out of 5, which is starting to seem like the average score for season 1 for me. That Deep Space Nine episode you referenced where they go to Ryza, it was, "Let he who lives without sin..." ... And it's brilliant. And it's brilliant. James, did something just happen?
I don't think anything happened.
Oh, no, see, you'd missed it. I repeated that twice, and I would say, James, did something just happen? And you were supposed to say, yes, I just repeated a moment in time. Anyway, that probably has something to do with John C. in a swimsuit, though. I don't actually remember much else about it. I do remember a little bit about it. Some jerk was trying to shut down Ryza and take away Jadzia in her bathing suit, and that really irritated me.
I remember all of it, it's supposed to be a very, very bad DS9 episode. The last time I saw it, which was maybe a couple of years ago, I didn't particularly think it was that bad. But then again, well, I've given high marks for season 1 TNG. So what do I know?
Yeah. Okay, so let me go back a little bit here. He says, if you want a good Klingon episode, there's plenty more later in TNG. Yes, I do believe TNG was probably very great for bringing the Klingon culture on, and DS9 even amped it up a little bit more. But Voyager? Are we talking about the Klingon ship that thought that B'Elanna's baby was their god or something? I thought that was horrible.
I don't know if I'm going to get hate mail, but I'm not sure there is a better Klingon episode in Voyager than Heart of Glory.
I thought that was the Heart of Glory? Is that... Hold on. Heart of Glory, that's not... That's TNG.
The TNG, yeah. Oh. The TNG episode that we reviewed, I think, is better than anything that ends up in Voyager as featuring the Klingons. Now, there's... It's Prophecy, right? Prophecy is the one with the the Klingon baby. There's also the Barge of the Dead, which is when which is kind of Klingon-ish in the sense that B'Elanna has thoughts going back to her mum. Now, I'm not a particularly big fan of that one, but I can imagine it.
Now, when we do Conspiracy next week, we're
and number one forum poster.
Oh no!
So,
oh.
We certainly always appreciate the feedback.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because as it stands now, when we do Conspiracy next week, we still only have Kieran McDuff. So he's been pretty good for us. We do appreciate it. But yeah, some of the posters have to make me think. And it's what I like is when you guys say something that makes me think. So, all right, well, let's go back into We'll Always Have Paris. Okay. So, basically, we open up the show with Captain Picard and Lieutenant whoever it is fencing. And during the match, a moment in time repeats itself. What do you guys think of the... And do it again.
It was like a bit like the glitch in the Matrix, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes. And he had to ask the bridge, hey, did something up there just happen? You know, what's going on? So obviously it happened in the bridge at the same time, because that's what he said. He just experienced a moment that repeats the same moment in time.
The bridge responded so casually, like, yes, a moment in time just repeated itself, like it's an everyday event.
Yeah.
You know, If that was you phoning home to your wife saying, has anything gone wrong? And she went, oh yeah, Lou, a moment in time just repeated itself. You'd be like, right, you're not worried about that? Is that not a bit unusual? Like, nah, it's fine.
And I think they missed the opportunity to lie to the captain when he said, did anything happen? She said, no, everything's fine here. Why? What did you experience? A moment in time repeating itself? Right, we'll send the doctor down.
Yeah, we'll send the doctor right down. Yeah, let him repeat that moment in time. Okay. Well then, Picard comes to the bridge, and he didn't even have time to change, did he? This was so urgent.
This is in the days before the holodeck can put the clothes on you. You had to actually change into whatever you're going to be wearing on the holodeck at this point.
I didn't get that was a holodeck. I thought that was just like a fencing room that was already on the ship.
Maybe. I'm just so used to like any activity that requires like a more kind of pedestrian setting is always recreated in the holodeck. Maybe that's more a kind of Voyager thing.
Huh.
Like in Nemesis, when Picard says, I'm away at the gym, I just assumed he was going to a gym in the holodeck.
Okay. Alright, well, he gets back to the bridge and, repeat, this is Dr. Paul Manheim. And you could see, just as soon as the name is mentioned, Picard's brain shoots to red alert. And even Troy gets the hit of emotion. You know, it was almost like a 33-car pileup just occurred in Picard's brain. Like, whoo, what the heck? All ships... Here, okay. if you guys have not realized by now, James is more the analytical guy, and I'm more the guy who asks questions like, when Dr. Mannheim asks for all ships, please respond. Now, what if there's 47,000 ships in the area? Do you think they'd all respond?
Do you have a serious question?
Exactly. You're the serious guy. I'm the guy who would ask a question like that.
Well, I mean, I think he means any rather than all. But I have to say, by the way, I do like... this is actually a weird episode for me, in a way. I think that it's really kind of quite spooky. And I think that the beginning in particular, I mean, it's got a very unique score to it. And, you know, when the time repeats itself, there's kind of like a really weird kind of feel to the episode. And, you know, by the time you've finished with a teaser and, you know, they're basically on their way to try to find these scientists that are out there that have done something bad and or they've done something that's now affecting the timeline. I think it's a nice, pretty good opener. I'm not entirely sure what non-linear time is, but I'll buy that for the moment.
I think this is we could have used this example of some, remember when they were first about to switch on the Large Hadron Collider, and all these kind of really weird theories were coming up, like the Earth was going to get sucked into a black hole created in Switzerland, or it was going to create time distortions. I wonder if this. Someone watched this episode one too many times.
There, perhaps.
You know, I also was thinking that since they actually repeated that moment in time, do you think maybe that threw them out of normal time? So the rest of the galaxy is actually moving on 3 seconds, 5 seconds ahead of time?
I think that, like, if you were to take it on a galactic level, there would be so many kind of time distortions just through gravity, because different regions of space would be experiencing time different speeds anyway. That, you know, I'm not sure how you would make sense of like a 3 second hiccup. I don't know, in the grand scheme of things, what it would affect. Or James would be better answer than me.
No, I don't have a good answer. I don't have a good answer on this.
Okay. So anyway, Paul Mannheim, when they start talking to him, when they start talking about him, Picard takes the towel and like bangs his leg a few times.
Yeah, you can tell that they're quite obviously trying to hammer you over the head with. Picard has something about Mannheim that he doesn't like. Mm-hmm. Or something that's certainly deep-rooted and annoying him, aggravating him, getting to him in some way. But I think the twist of what the Mannheim connection is actually quite well done.
Mm-hmm. And there's the bit, I mean, directly following this when obviously Troy is aware of this and then she approaches the captain and basically suggests, hey, Captain, there's something we should probably talk about, and I think you know what it is. And he initially starts off by saying, oh, no, we can discuss this completely and open. And he says, you have very strong feelings here. And it's almost as if, shut up, Troy, shut up, I'm leaving. It seemed very strange. He didn't want to talk about it in public, but he was very keen that it was noted that he was happy to talk about it in public.
Except for when she obviously was starting to press a nerve, you know, unresolved feelings can cloud your judgment, and as if Picard's never had his judgment clouded a few times this season. Okay.
Yeah, it kind of just seemed like when someone, if you know, you talk to people, we aren't psychic, and they say, you're upset, and you go, no, I'm not. It seemed like that kind of thing where she's saying, you're upset about something. He's like, no, I'm fine.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about you guys. You're both married, so you obviously understand. So let's compare how many times it takes. I know this is a tangent. How many times does it take to ask the same question to get the proper answer? Like, okay, what have I done? Nothing. All right, what have I done? Nothing. Okay, but what have I done? What you did was, okay, so usually mine is about 3 to 4 times before my wife will give in. What about you guys?
The equation for working that out has not been written yet.
Changes every time, huh?
Exactly.
And I'm not prepared to go on the record on this.
Hey, my wife doesn't listen to the show. Does yours?
Actually, no, no, I don't think so. The only reason why she would listen to the show if I were to if I were to be killed or something, she might listen to the show. But she doesn't listen to the show.
Okay, but
she saved. I've mentioned it before that she's saving. I can't get her to watch Star Trek. She's saving up Star Trek to when she has a horrible debilitating illness that keeps her in hospital for like 6 months or so. So when she breaks her hip and she can't walk for 4 months, apparently she'll sit down and get through the trek, but not until then.
Okay. Well, just remember that whenever she does an episode of TNG, she needs to stop and listen to our review. Oh, that man of mine. Anyway. The Café des Artistes. Did I say that right?
Sorry, I was going to say as about convincingly as any of the other French speakers would have said it in the episode. Because the thing that I noticed in this, in particular, so Picard goes off down to the holodeck to do something or other. I mean, it's a little bit freaky as far as I can tell. But in particular, the woman who's sitting there, who's waiting for her date, I assume, and who seems to have an uncanny parallel with Picard's story, right?
Yes.
I don't know if that was intentional. I mean, when I say intentional, not from the writing perspective, but from the holodeck program perspective. I don't know if Picard said, hey, I'd love to go and see Paris, and I really need this young girl to be there, mooing over the fact that her boyfriend or someone has stood her up. Because I don't quite understand how it would happen randomly. But I'll put all the money on the table here to suggest that she's not French.
No. That's Isabel Lorca. I believe it's Isabel Garcia Lorca.
Oh, then prove me wrong.
I don't know.
But it's a Spanish name at the moment. Spanish name.
She could have married a Spanish person. But, I mean, you know, no, I don't think so. I actually got more of an Italian vibe on her. I mean, I don't know why, but she just kind of had an Italian vibe. But amazingly enough, he asked for the Café des Artistes on this particular day, as it was on this particular day. And somehow the computer, who obviously must be telepathic, knows what he's thinking. I think the whole point of the writers were trying to do was she was the woman that he left.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they were trying to do. I didn't quite see how that was possible to have happened without Picard actually, programming it up himself, which I didn't kind of buy that he would.
Yeah, I didn't see that. Okay. Anything?
Yeah, I think it would have taken like maybe 2 weeks to describe that. Like, you know, yeah, it's this cafe, and in it there's this woman, and the guy's going to meet her, but he's never come along, and she's really upset, and she waited all day, and like all these other variables. So, but it seemed like maybe the computer read all Picard's logs and diaries and just kind of knows and extrapolates what that day would have been.
Okay. All right. What'd you guys think of the cafe itself, though?
It looked pretty French, apart from the waiter being really friendly.
Okay. Yeah.
I like the see-through menu. I thought that was nice. And then they showed you the cityscape of Paris, and there's obviously the Eiffel Tower still there. And I don't think many people realize how new the Eiffel Tower is. It's not a particularly old monument or tower, I suppose. But it's got this big kind of like waste sewer pipe going through underneath it. Or I don't know what that was supposed to be. It seemed a bit weird.
I thought it was a transport thing.
I mean, that's probably more more likely than a giant sewer. I admit that.
Yeah. I don't think they would need a sewer at that time. The only thing I was wondering about is, don't you think whatever Paris's health department would have a problem with pigeons walking around the restaurant, even if it was an outdoor thing?
I think in Britain as well, if you're eating outdoors, pigeons are unavoidable.
Oh, that's true. That's true. But it would actually, you know, be kind of sad to have a nice meal and, you know, let a pigeon drop right in your, I don't know what French food is. You know, I've never had French, so I have no idea. I'm Italian.
I don't know how often, because what generally happens with pigeons is they're not kind of flying around while you're eating. They're not that brave. It's when a table's left empty once somebody goes away. And if the waiter doesn't clear it quick enough, that's when you normally have a pigeon problem.
Mm. Okay.
Unless you live somewhere like Brighton, where the pigeons are super brave.
Mm. No, it's the seagulls in Brighton.
Yeah.
It's the seagulls that come after you, and they will. They won't wait for you to leave the table.
Okay. All right, well, anyway, the poor girl on the holodeck, why? What did that do to drive him away? And I was thinking, wouldn't it have been a hoot if Picard said, well, obviously, if he left you, he's gay.
Yeah, well, let's try to make him feel better. Like, obviously, the man was gay. Go on with your life, yeah.
Absolutely. But since you're here, and I'm here too... Maybe the pigeons ain't the only things going on here today. But, no, maybe he had no choice. Maybe he was afraid. Crap, enough of this self-indulgence. Exit!
Yeah, Picard seems to have a... I'm forgetting how Season 1 Picard has a very short fuse.
Yes. Right. Just like the one of the last episodes we did, you know. So beam on down, because we not only make weapons, we make complete weapon systems. That's all we get. I mean, I would love to have heard the salesman's pitch continue. So okay, time distortions were affecting the starship Lalo. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that was right.
Who described it as a hiccup, which Data describes as a spasmodic inhalation with closure of the glottis accompanied by a particular sound. Is that right? I'm doing that off memory.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
And it's that this is the kind of Season 1 trope of Data that, you know, his definition for everything is based around kind of like the Oxford English Dictionary.
Yes.
Rather than actual experience.
But that's a wrong body sound. He believes this sound would be more like a, or this phenomena would be more like a, that's enough, Data. So I guess if they're not going to do it, maybe we've got guts enough to do it. Which body function do you think that this was more like?
Probably a bum convulsion.
I'm surprised you were going to ask the question, Lou, on that.
Why not? I dare to be different.
No, I'm pretty sure that's the direction they were headed in.
Okay, let's see, Doctor. Answer this. Mannheim was working on time gravity when he left. Well, what do you think he was trying to do? Oh, that's right. He already asked you that question. You said you don't know.
Actually, can I take a 2-minute tangent on this?
Absolutely.
Because I remember watching a lot of the TNG when I was growing up, and there's a lot of the TNG that have science stories threaded through them, and these are the ones that I really, really loved. I, you know, for some reason, I kind of move towards these stories, things like where no one has gone before, where they do something kind of vaguely scientific and they extrapolate, and I really like that. There's the Nth Degree with Barclay when he ends up building a big, you know, a huge amount of technology because he's been given superhuman brain power. Now, I always remember and always place this episode in that same kind of camp. Because, you know, there's a scientist doing some scientist-y kind of stuff, and isn't that great? And I hadn't seen this episode for quite a while, or maybe not seen this episode with my full attention. And my recollection was always that this is one of those other great scientific episodes that I had a big memory of growing up. And by the way, I mean, I didn't end up doing, you know, my work in, you know, in maths and physics, because that's where my family came from. I basically ended up going down that route because I think I was interested in that, and I'm pretty sure I was interested in that because I liked Star Trek and liked all the stories that they told. So in no small part was I pushed in that direction by Trek. However, revisiting this episode in particular, there's nothing on the science side that either makes sense or is based in anything too reasonable or is even an interesting idea that they use as a way of threading a story around. So I was a little bit disappointed when, you know, when I came to rewatch this, because I actually think that, you know, the things that they try to put out there in terms of science, the time and gravity. Okay, there is a link between time and gravity, and it's defined. You know, you can define it through general relativity, and you have things like time dilation and stuff like that. That's all relatively interesting, but what they're talking about here is different, and I think they're just making it up on the fly.
Yeah, I don't think they have a science advisor for this one.
No, but if we looked at other episodes, and Paul, you're on for Where No One Has Gone Before, I really thought that they had a nugget of something that they then extrapolated well. Whereas here, someone basically heard gravity, time, non-linear, yeah, why not? And I didn't think that there was anything at the core that was actually someone being playful with the, while keeping respect to the underlying philosophy of scientific knowledge. It was just stuff. But my memories were that it was better than this, so I'm on a little bit of a downer today.
Well, it was better than this because you didn't understand it then.
I think that's true. You know, when you don't know anything, then you could be, you know, you could probably be hoodwinked into thinking that this is sound, and you know, there's enough of a mystery there to keep you going. But I was surprised that when you go back to some of them are very, very good. The Nth Degree is very good with Barclay as well. But other ones, they just fall a little flat.
It doesn't really help that, you know, Mannheim himself doesn't really seem to put much weight behind his own theories. Like, normally these mad scientists want to preserve the creation they've made at all costs. He's like, shut it down, get rid of it. It was a mistake, a horrible mistake. You know, if someone had some conviction behind it, if someone was kind of pushing their belief of the theory, it might help the kind of audience believe in it. And, like, I would imagine that for you, James, there'll be a lot of, like, sci-fi or a lot of Star Trek episodes where your knowledge of science kind of, you look at it and you think, well, sometimes maybe you wish, well, maybe I wish I didn't really know that much about science so I could just enjoy it for what it is. I kind of think that the same, that every time I watch an episode of Star Trek, if it brings up a scientific theory that I don't know about, I almost always go away and research it to the point where I totally ruin the episode for myself because I realise how implausible it is.
Okay, I understand where you're coming from. What I usually like instead, so I usually just like to see them take base ideas, even if they're relatively simple, and extrapolate and say, well, we know that it's not true and it's not correct and we know that it can't really be done, but we're going to try to go off in this direction. What I don't like, and by the way, it's a relatively thin line, I don't like when you fall too much into fantasy, which I would usually describe as, you know, it's not a wormhole, it's a magic door. And actually, I think there is a difference between describing something as a wormhole or a magic door. I think one of them is respectful and is based on some type of understanding of the theory. Even if you wouldn't be able to travel through a wormhole yourself, and people can accept that that's, you know, that certain portrayals of wormholes within sci-fi aren't 100% accurate. But I still respect when they try to keep that, and they just say, well, let's just call it a magic door, and let's give everyone a sword, and that's about it.
Hmm. Yeah.
But that's just me. I know that I'm weird.
I wouldn't say that. Because it wouldn't be nice. Okay. Yeah. So, open a channel. This is Captain J... the guy in the ship up here. I need you to shut your shields down so that I can clap my hands real loud. And then... Anyway, what do you guys think of all that?
I liked it. It was nice to see Picard kind of tongue-tied for once.
No, and I agree. And actually, I think that if this was better executed, I have no problem with them having like the A-line story, whichever one of the stories that is, wrapped around the kind of the personal story of Picard and stuff. That's been done before. I think it's perfectly acceptable. So I don't mind that there's this extra plot. I'm pretty sure that there was only a couple of weeks ago when they decided not to beam someone directly to sickbay, but this week they managed to beam them directly to sickbay, which is good. So at least they're learning there. And I quite liked Watson. You know, it's also nice to have a binary star system on display, and you know, things like that. That's always good.
Okay. All right, so then we get a man and a woman beaming up to sickbay where Crusher hypos him completely unconscious. And then Picard runs in and we find out, of course, dun-dun-dun, she was a former girlfriend, or supposed girlfriend, or almost girlfriend, that he pretty much bailed out on. What do you think? Now, Janice Manheim, she was pretty good-looking herself, but let's face it, she was no Gabrielle.
What's that supposed to mean?
I don't know. It's just something about Fran Hugo. You know I like accents. And the... why? What did that do to drive him away? I don't know. I just think she was just so much hotter than Janice Manheim was.
But she was pretty awful. Half her age.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. You got me there.
Okay. I thought she was a pretty good-looking woman, and I thought Mr. Manheim was particularly strange-looking. He kind of looked like Niles Crane with a beard.
I think that's true. He's punching well above his weight there, I think.
Yeah.
By the way, I mean, I was doing some research. I did some research on Memory Alpha. I wasn't aware of this, but the actress that plays Dr. Manheim's wife is from the Mamas and Papas.
Was she? Oh, right.
Yeah, and I had no idea. She's actually famous for stuff outside of being in season one TNG. And it's now, you know, probably 20 years since I first saw this, that I'm actually thinking, yeah, actually she probably had a career outside of this episode.
Well, yeah, I suppose they all would, but, I mean, she was a...
Is that the second... second kind of famous musician in season one that's been on.
Oh, who did we have?
It's maybe not been yet, but Mick Fleetwood plays one of the...
Oh, yeah, the fish people.
Yeah, the fish, but that's in The Emissary? Is it? No.
Well.
It's not. It's the one with the... Obviously, it's the one with Troy's mum in season two.
Oh, is it season two?
Yeah.
I thought that one was season one.
Hmm. Was it season two?
I think it's season. I'm. By all means, click away.
It's an early one.
Yeah. I'm actually surprised, by the way, that when they do talk to the people, and you know, obviously there are only two people that get beamed aboard, because the research outpost that has been set up, everyone else has been killed, and they kind of say it in a very matter of fact kind of way that, oh, we lost our entire division of scientists working there. And they're never questioned on this at all. And considering that only a couple of weeks ago we had the terraformers and the people dying on the terraforming planet and stuff, to me it doesn't sound like a particularly a healthy career choice to be a scientist out in space.
No.
You're unlikely to survive.
Oh, okay. Yes, I see it now. Michelle Phillips is one of the thin mama. Anyway, that was completely irrelevant. All right. So now, like I said, Picard arrives to sickbay, and Jean-Luc, I thought the voice sounded familiar. I'm surprised, you know, Dr. Crusher didn't like absolutely murder the woman. The look on her face.
His voice would be pretty familiar, as in like the only man in France that speaks with a very heavy English accent.
Well, you know, again, that's by today's standard. I don't know. Anyway. Oh, yeah, you've done well, Jean-Luc. The doctor is jealous of me, of course, but, you know, I'm much hotter than she is anyway. But, how was my husband? Well, that didn't happen, but I wish it did.
There does seem to be a lot of unresolved sexual tension between Crusher and Picard in these early years. And coming off the back of The Arsenal of Freedom and things, there definitely is things in play. So I'm surprised that then, well, it wasn't because of the writers per se, but I'm surprised that then, obviously, only in then 2 episodes' time, Crusher disappears for a year.
Well, it's probably because of Janice Manheim.
Maybe that's why she disappeared, because she just couldn't take looking at Picard anymore. She just had to not be around him for a year. Mm.
But she's got a big picture of him on her office at Starfleet Medical.
Maybe she feels bad at it.
Or maybe it's one of those pictures where Picard is standing there with his hands folded as he moves back and forth and winks at her a few times.
Maybe.
Okay. Incidentally, Captain, the effects are really interesting as we get on a turbo lift, move around, and then come on the turbo lift again. What do you think about the two sets of people actually not only redoing that moment in the turbo lift, but actually able to talk to each other? Where Data, I feel no ill effects. Neither do I.
That was a bit kind of strange. I don't know how. I don't think they managed to kind of pull off that idea very well visually. It was a bit kind of disjointed, and it looked like a really strange crap effect.
Really?
Oh, I'm going to be a lot more generous, because I loved it for whatever reason. Especially because Data ends up speaking to himself, right? Or not speaking to him, he finishes the other guy's sentence with the, you know, neither do I line. But of course, they've used this before with, when Data and Laura are on board, and there's always they can get it to work well with a lot of good back and forth. I didn't particularly mind it.
Of course, the only thing that beat this was Picard walking down a corridor with himself, you know, as he repeats this moment in time. That was pretty awesome. You know what's going on, don't you? I have to get to the shuttle. Tell me what's going on. I have to get to the shuttle.
You're talking about Times Square here, right? In season 2. A tangent. When I watched that recently, I didn't remember how completely useless the other Picard was, because he is completely useless and he doesn't tell anyone anything, and he spends about 40 minutes of the episode in some type of, not quite a coma, but at least he behaves as if he's been hit on the head with a large mallet. So he's not... that episode could have been over in like 3 minutes had the other Picard just said, hey, we've got this thing coming up, you should think about doing something different this time.
Right. Yeah, because he laid in sickbay making his faces. I mean, can you imagine the direction there? I'll just look there, sit, lay there, and look confused, like, oh, the hell, what's happening until you'll... I didn't like that either, but... So anyway, but no, what I was getting at is, I guess, what would we be like? We're in a turbo lift. We just walked in. We're talking. All of a sudden, the doors open, and bam, there's another one of us standing out there. That'd be kind of funky.
I think it would definitely be something you might go to the doctor about.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Start to really be more freaked out.
Say that all again, because you were in a time distortion just a second ago. Say that again.
But to be honest, that's somewhat ironic. I was about to say that had you not watched enough Star Trek, that you'd probably be quite freaked out about coming across yourself.
Right. Yeah. That was one of the things I said in one of our very early episodes of the Loot Trek Show. And you've had too much Star Trek win. And one of mine, I love it, is that you're standing next to a Ferengi in the post office and you don't even flinch. So, okay. So there's a second lab, and Riker has to get down there somehow, but no one knows what the energy is, or how to shut it off, how to deal with it. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, was it a pretty cool effect? I don't know if I'm going pretty far, but I want to say there are like three mirrors that were like circling around. Wasn't that
right? Are you talking about the kind of effect that was in the center of the lab?
That, yes.
That we would start to recover from. Yeah, I thought that one was kind of cool. It was cool because it looked like a real effect, because I don't know if they'd be able to do an effect like that then digitally. I think it was probably just a case of like a few mirrors spinning around a bit.
Oh, I got the impression that it was kind of like CG added over the top. I didn't think it was a, and maybe they put it onto a physical effect. But I thought it was a all digital or you know effectively done in post.
Maybe it was, but I did think it looked out of all the effects in this episode, I thought it was the kind of most charming of them all.
Yeah, I think that's. That's fair. I like actually. By the way, I think that it's interesting that the kind of the data that we see in like you know latter TNG, he I think he actually starts in this episode. What I'm trying to say here is completely backwards. Up until now, whenever we've seen kind of like scientists, they've never kind of like engaged data. I think this is one of the first episodes where Data is actually brought in onto this, you know, into his new kind of like scientist role, because where no one has gone before, Data wasn't involved in that. And then there are a couple of other episodes where there's a scientist on, and Data's not really shown any interest in science. And I think this is the one where all of a sudden, I think the penny must have dropped and said, "Well, you know, scientists are probably." Quite logical, kind of analytical people, and we've got an android there that's probably good at reasoning, and I think at this point it's the first time that they marry this kind of scientific storyline with Data.
Yeah, and I think I kind of take that for granted, because in terms of watching TNG, I generally watch kind of season 4 and above, and by that point. Is your go-to science guy?
Yeah, it was surprising to me, like rewatching and like looking out that he wasn't like that from the beginning. He was much more of a, well, he was much more of the just the child kind of a guy. He wasn't there as a you know, he wasn't there as a replacement for Spock in terms of the science.
Okay, so when he beams down and he encounters those, I don't know what you would call them, but basically Mannheim security that tries to kill him. I like the way they showed it this time, where he gets fired on, and unlike the Terraformer one, we actually get to see him destroy the equipment at the time.
Yeah, it looked like an episode of the Crystal Maze. I don't know if you get the Crystal Maze in America, Lou.
No, never heard of it.
It was basically a show. It ran on British television for... Was it something like 10 years, James?
I would have thought at least that, yeah.
And it was basically this giant game show where you would bring a panel onto the show. So it was generally like kind of, you know, people that worked together, like, you know, a local fire squad, or, you know, people that worked in an office together would go on the Crystal Maze. And it was like a series of challenges that you had to do as a team and as individuals. And at the end, you got to go in and compete to try and win a prize. But the challenges were something like what Data was doing. It was like, you know, hide behind boxes so the lasers don't get you, or like get the code right for this puzzle so you don't get locked in a room and that kind of thing.
All right. Well, since you went into that, I want to ask a question. I don't know if I've ever asked James this. In the British version of Life on Mars, did you ever watch that?
Yeah.
So when you say the British version, but there's an American version?
Yes.
Yeah, the American version is weird.
Well,
wow.
Yes, because I saw a little bit of the British version, I thought, this is weird. So I guess it's where you're at. But yes, they actually redid Life on Mars. There was like 17 or 18 episodes, and then it killed off.
What was really weird for me is, like, I think the ending to the British one is one of the best endings ever, and the ending to the American one is
crap.
Just like, where did that come from?
Where it came from, because they were canceled so quickly, they had to come up with something. But they say, and I was listening to a commentary version of the ending, and they said that this is where they were always going. Had they had another season, they still would have ended with this, and I can't imagine it. But, you know, James, if you want, you maybe try and find it, and I won't spoil it for you. But, yeah, I do want to see more of the British version of Life on Mars. I just saw, I believe, what may be the pilot, and just thought, I'm sorry, I hate to say this, but it is just so different to watch a British television show, to me.
It's very, very British in its delivery. I think it's one of those things where it's definitely made for a British audience. Like, they didn't make it with an international audience in mind. There's a lot of things that you would only really get the atmosphere and the jokes and even the politics if you are British and kind of off a certain age. Like, I think that I'm kind of maybe even slightly too young to get a lot of the references in it, because it's talking about the kind of politics and culture of the 70s quite a lot. And, you know, it's something I'm familiar with from other films and just kind of general knowledge, but I think it was one of the best kind of TV series for playing on atmosphere that I'd ever seen.
Okay. So you think, Paul, that Sam Tyler was anything close to the British version, or do you think they were just way worlds apart?
No, I think it's like comparing the British version of Sherlock and then the American show Elementary. They're two fundamentally different things based on the same concept.
But I guess, you know, it wouldn't make sense. Maybe I should just go ahead and watch them and see if I can find them somewhere and at least get a base reference of what it was like for them. Because I sure like Mr. Bean, Rowan Atkins.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe watch some like British crime dramas first.
Ah.
Watch some like British crime films, like watch Lock, Stock and that kind of thing before you, and try and get into the kind of the kind of mentality of it. Now you could watch Scottish crime drama. You could watch Taggart. I'm sure you'd enjoy that.
Tiger?
It's called Taggart. And there's another one called Rebus, and you'd enjoy them.
How do you spell those?
So Taggart is this T-A-G-A-R-T, and Rebus is R-E-B-U-S.
Okay. Alright. Okay. Yeah, I mean, obviously, some Scottish accents are very hard for me to get.
Tiger will be very difficult because it's based in Glasgow, so it's like the west coast of Scotland. Rebus is based in Edinburgh, so the people will have a similar accent to mine.
Okay, cool. All right, okay, let's go back. So we got Data down on the lab trying to get in when he comes across these goofy desk lights that just only open up to a certain point.
Lou, huh? In my notes, I've got that down as the light bar door is really funky. I liked it. But also, I have 2 points, which is, I don't think that Nemesis Data would have been able to squeeze through.
No.
And I don't think Dr. Mannheim would have been able to squeeze through either.
That's such a good point, because do you think they opened all the way for them and somehow it just glitched?
I'm not sure. It almost suggested that it was, well, I took away from it that it was hard to get into and they would only open as far as it needed to for, you know, a little person to be able to squeeze through. But Data's smaller than Dr. Mannheim.
Yeah, considerably.
And he's only just getting through himself. And, you know, I thought that was quite lucky.
You know what it kind of made me think of when I saw him, not back then, obviously, but now today when I watched it again, is the chompers on Galaxy Quest. It's like, what's the point of having chompers in the middle of a hallway? And I can see the security aspect of having the desk lights on. But I don't know. So I guess the point is, you touch them, what? You get burned?
Immediate death, I would have thought.
Wow.
That, you know, whenever there's a big bright bar of something, you don't want to touch it.
So what if Data just like phasered each one of them one by one?
Did he take a phaser with him?
Yes, because he had to take out the...
Oh yeah, he did. Yeah, no, you're right. He should have tried it.
Yeah. Okay. Hmm. All right.
And I like that. I mean, going back to a point that I made a little bit earlier. I mean, this episode is. I thought that this was better than it. Kind of, I think it ended up being, because I think from the perspective of the main story, which I'm gonna, you know, it's gonna be the time distortion thing in the lab. I mean, basically, there's an accident somewhere that causes this thing to blow up, and they go there. They beam Data down. Data goes into the room. He picks something up and he plugs a hole. And that's it, right? Mm-hmm. That's the only thing that happens on that part of the storyline. There's no consequence of that. There's no challenge even in doing it. I thought it was better than this, and it seems to be a very, very straightforward A to B kind of a go down, plug the hole, and you know, we'll talk later.
Hmm. Well, there was 3 Datas.
Actually, that was cool. That was cool. I have to admit, I like the 3 Datas. And I also had one of the questions that I had when he picked up the antimatter to throw into the hole, or the time hole, mm-hmm. is how do you store antimatter? What are they really using to store antimatter here? Because it's very difficult for you to store antimatter.
Well, obviously, it was just in a glass container with a... opening it on the side.
Yeah, it wouldn't work like that.
No, what if he accidentally drops it or something? I mean, isn't the container made of matter?
Yeah, well, you'd have to, if you ever did want to store antimatter, you'd have to confine it in it's actually hard. It really is hard to store antimatter. But, I mean, the best you can come up with is some type of containment field that would prevent, so you'd control the antimatter not touching matter somehow. But even that has got a lot of complications around it. So the idea that you can just pick up like almost a bucket of antimatter and pour it into a time distortion hole is a little bit far-fetched. But I'm nitpicking here.
Right.
you sure there's not like a special form of Tupperware that can store antimatter?
Can resist antimatter for like 14 hours or so. So you can scoop the antimatter up and then pour it out elsewhere before it's disintegrated.
Actually, you can use your, I don't know if you realize this, but you can use your butter tub. Once you're done with the butter, you clean it out really good, soap and water, and you can use that as an antimatter container.
Is it because it's been pre-greased?
Yes.
One thing I really understand is how like the middle data kind of basically just decides, yep, it's me, I'm the real one. Like, I'm the one that's in the right time. Like, how did you figure that one out?
He just said it was me. It's me! I believe it was the middle data.
But then, like, surely, like, one of them should have said it just kind of in front of him, and one of them should have said it just in behind him. So it should have been like, it's me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they should have had at least a minute of arguing. It's me. Think about it. You know, and then go on a little bit. But it just seems to me they all put their little antimatter thing in there anyway.
Don't they converge at the end? You know, one of them says, "Oh, it's not me. I'm not the guy." So he goes and stands there and waits for the other data to catch up with him. Mm-hmm. Who then waits for the other data to catch up with him?
Yeah, it seemed like I think it was a second data in reality, because by the time the third one shows up, by the time he gets in there, boom, it's already done. So I don't know. Maybe it was a second one. Here's something we missed. What do you think about Picard and Janice's interactions when they were finally together? You know, why did you leave me there?
I think she's hoping that, like, the old man dies so she can get Picard.
Oh, no kidding. Wouldn't you rather be on the flagship of the Federation than trying to go back and, it's all there, Janice, let me do it again.
Yeah.
You screwball. No, I don't want to be there.
Yeah. Dr. Kronos was a bit creepy.
Yeah.
And it's weird how he was, as soon as Data plugged the hole, he was absolutely fine.
Yeah!
Nothing to worry about. Just absolutely fine all of a sudden.
That was pretty convenient. Okay. So the crystal formation spinning around, and he was able to stop it, and they poof, disappear. Why do you think they just disappeared instead of, like, just became inert?
You talking about the datas?
Not the datas, the crystal, the mirrors that were revolving around.
I kind of took it that, like, each mirror was the kind of shattering off the different dimension, and when it's closed, you know, you don't see any of the other dimensions anymore.
That's right.
It's just, like, one mirror, though.
And then we see the freaky lights flowing around, almost like disco lights flowing around, and that's when they have to decide, which one is me? It's me! Okay, so... But anyway, Mannheim is feeling so much better now. And he wants to go back and do it again. But first, Picard wants to take her to the holodeck to visit Paris again. But this time, Gabrielle isn't there. It would be such a... Okay, so we've already established that wasn't supposed to be Janine. It was Gabrielle. Different girl completely. But it'd be so weird if she was still there and said, "What happened to you? I was hoping you'd come back."
So you think that Janice goes in and she catches Picard with Gabrielle?
With Gabrielle.
Sitting at the...
Well, not that. I was thinking when Janice comes into the holodeck, was it a Counselor Troy who brought her to the holodeck?
Yeah.
And then when she goes in, we'd still have Gabrielle on the table. You know, sitting at the table next to him, talking to Fran. Or something, and she would, you know, she's still trying to interact with Picard. But anyway, yeah.
But by the way, I always find, I mean, maybe I'm just more sympathetic to the women on the show, but I would imagine, and hey, if we've got any female listeners, maybe they can let us know, but, you know, if you're invited into the holodeck and it's abundantly clear that there's this recreation from 15 years in the past that Picard obviously hasn't just created, but he must have created sometime in the, you know, sometime the week before or something like that. I would have run a mile. I think at this point, Picard's come across pretty desperate and obsessive.
Yeah, he's got Geordi LaForge syndrome.
He has slightly, right? He said, "Oh, Janice, come down to the holodeck. I've prepared something special for us. It's just as I remember from 15 years ago. Not a single detail out of place. I've been working on it for the last 12 years.
Tell me, have I got your pants correct?"
Yeah. I guess it's like another Dr. Brahms. How many more programs do you have? One for every day, one for every mood. Well, Picard only has one mood. It's grumpy. Okay. But anyway, he wants to say goodbye properly this time, and she thanks him, and after... Oh, what do you guys think about when she says, "Well, so much for my dramatically romantic exit," or something like that, and then the computer reacts and gives her the exit? All you need to do is say "exited" in a sentence, and poof, there it is.
Yeah, I think it's like my smartphone at the moment, where if you say "Okay, Google," it launches Google. So if you're watching a YouTube video that says like "Google" in it, it sometimes takes out the YouTube video and pops up with like "How can I help you?" Like, "Go away."
Go away. Leave me alone. Okay, well, anyway, I'm sure you guys might have more to say about this, but it's off to the next place in the Blue Parrot Cafe, and Deanna's buying, by the way.
That was a very TOS ending, with the kind of cheesy music and the three of them kind of giggling together, like, how funny are we?
Yeah.
I think TOS is the only way to describe it. Apparently it's supposed to be a reference to Casablanca. I don't think you necessarily need it at this, you know, to append onto a back of a sci-fi story at this stage.
Okay. Okay, so I guess we're pretty much coming to an end to this. Go on, James. I hear a...
No. Actually, no. I have my bullet points, and I take the bullet points off as we go through and as we chat about things. I think it's a... It obviously lasted 45 minutes, but there's not a huge amount there. I mean, we touched on almost every single thing that happened in the episode, and it doesn't feel like much, to be honest. And then, you know, I mean, it's a bit of a myth from my perspective. And right at the top of the episode, they say that they're on their way to on their way looking for shore leave, and I'm pretty sure we've had shore leave relatively recently as well. So I'm even calling these guys out for being pretty lazy. And Picard's already at shore leave. He's already downstairs playing with his sword. So
and that wasn't a sexual reference, guys. Shut everyone up. Didn't anybody laugh? He's playing with his sword. "And I see your Schwartz is as big as mine." Anyway. I don't think James gets me yet. All right. Well then, unless you guys have any more, we should go on to the end.
No, I think James is right that there was not a huge amount of substance for this to stick your teeth into.
Right. Yes. It's just a good thing the ship was still in space at the time. I mean, that's the only fascinating thing about this. Sorry. All right. Well then, do you want to do the ending, James, or do you want me to?
Oh, can I go last? I'd like to go last on the summary, because I think I have... You know how sometimes we bring a certain impression of what the story is like or what a rating should be, and we have a chat, and sometimes we converge and sometimes we diverge. And I really think that on my rating, I think I've fallen by more than I've ever fallen before in all the 20-odd episodes that we've done so far.
Okay, here we go.
So let me go last, because I don't want to be completely out on my own.
Okay.
So I'll see whether or not you can save me.
Okay, we'll see. I'll do it then. All right, it's now time to give our final thoughts and ratings for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the most worst and 5 being the best. love and loss, lost love. You grow apart the entire time wondering how she's doing, you know. I do kind of have a grade school crush that I had at one time, and she now lives in, you know, many, many hundreds of miles away. So it's like that one, what would it be like had you taken the left turn at Albuquerque instead of the right turn? And that's something you'll never know. And obviously for Picard, he got to run into her, by mistake, no less. But still, it's really cute. The one that got away and got to say goodbye properly this time. If you could have said that, if you could have did that, if only you could have changed this, it'd drive you crazy. So, you know, obviously it's time to let them go. Now, you know, you also, when you find out when she's already married, so you're pretty much done. As far as the episode, yeah, it's kind of ho-drum, you know, so-so. So I can't pretty much give it higher than a 3. Middle of the road, and so hopefully maybe next week's show, Conspiracy, will be a little more mind-blowing. What do you think?
Very good. Very, very good.
What about you, Paul?
Well, I mean, it's definitely not the worst, so it's not a 1. It's certainly not the best, so it's not a 5. And I would say, even for season 1, this one kind of just falls short of the middle as well, so I'd have to really give this one a 2.
Okay. And Doctor?
Okay, I was coming in, I was seriously coming into this before I watched the episode and thinking, I love this episode. This is a great episode. It's a great kind of weird mystery science infused episode, and it's got a nice personal story wrapped around it. And I was kind of coming in at a 5. I'm thinking, this is one of the ones that I remember from the original run in season 1, and I thought that I was all up for this being, you know, for them being able to prove to me how great this was written. I've already mentioned it on the science side. I think that story is nothing more than, oh, there's an explosion, we'll send someone down to plug a hole, and he does so. I think that's the end of that. There's nothing that they use in the science story as a way of either mirroring or give an insight into anything that the characters go through. So in other episodes, you would have, you know, we've mentioned the nth degree. The nth degree is, you know, Barclay learns stuff, and a lot of what he does is, in a way, kind of like a reflection of his character. And it gets built out not just on the actual technical science kind of like standard storytelling way, but it's also a personal story as well that is kind of mirrored and is intertwined in that. In here, I don't think we have that at all. I think there was a potential for it, sure. And the way that Picard has his old romance kind of around, and, you know, the stories of, you know, lost love and stuff could have been there. But frankly, Lou, I think you had a better summing up of how that would have been tied together than what the episode gave us. Because I didn't really feel much for this side storyline with Picard and his first love. Mm-hmm. And it certainly wasn't wrapped around the main A story in a way that kind of some of the greatest Trek is. Unfortunately, I'm coming in at a 2 here as well. And, you know, going from a 5 down to a 2 based on having thought about this a bit more and really being quite disappointed about how thin the episode is something that I'm, you know, something that surprises me.
Okay.
That sounds to me like you met a girl drunk in the bar, and by the time you got back to your house after a 2-hour tube journey, she had gone from a 5 to a 2.
Usually it's the other way around. Okay. Well, yeah, you have had 1 5, James. It's where no one has gone before.
I know, yeah.
And I have not had a 5 yet, so we've got 2 episodes left.
I'm really looking forward to you breaking your long stand in a non-5 rating with the neutral zone in a couple of weeks. Or are you going to save it for the child?
The child. Oh, that's a different season, though. I mean, you know. The child. The child was an interesting concept. Oh, wait. We're not talking about that, though. So we'll go off of that later. Okay. Yeah, that's good. All right. Well, then. Okay, Paul. So, hey, thank you very much for coming on. And yeah, it's great having you. So let me see in season two. I don't have you anywhere listed. So if you can think of a season two episode that you would want to be on, that would be good.
When's the next one with the Traveler in it?
That's in season four. That's Remember Me, right, the next. Okay,
well, I'll pre-book that one just now, but season two. I'll have a look through and see.
Okay.
On the next episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Don't trust anyone. Remember that, Jean-Luc.
Sabotage strikes the highest ranks of the Starfleet Command.
Regular security, emergency.
And threatens the future of the entire Federation.
What is that?
But do evil parasites hold the key to this deadly conspiracy?
You'll be one of us soon.
Find out on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Join us next week as we review Season 1, Episode 25, Conspiracy. Until then, I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London. Thanks for listening.
And I've been Paul from Edinburgh.
He's been Sick Paul. Take care and good night.